Good afternoon. Good. Third time, good afternoon. Okay, we're about ready to begin. That's a tough act to follow that we had at lunch. Those of us that are on the speaking circuit steal stories from each other. I got some good ones from Rhett. Tomorrow I'm going up to Dyersburg, Tennessee to speak to a group, and I'll probably use some of those stories. So it's good I attended that luncheon. Some of you have asked me about why I'm hobbling around with this cane, and I'll tell you the truth. I have a cabin in northern Colorado, right south of Laramie, Wyoming. And last spring I went up to Wyoming, went quail hunting with Vice President Cheney, and got shot in the butt. That's what you use when you have to introduce yourself, you see. We're going to talk about Farm Bill. College professors are geared to 50 minutes, and that's about what we'll do, something like that. And then we'll have a dialogue back and forth. So start thinking about what you have on your mind. I worked on my first farm bill in 1968, for whatever that's worth. That means either that I have a lot of wisdom and experience, or I'm over the hill, one or the other, and you can decide. Some of you old-timers will remember the gentleman that I started working on farm bills with, Earl Butz. Anybody in here remember him? He is 96 years old, lives in a retirement village in Lafayette, Indiana. We talk on the phone occasionally. He is still Vinnie Gerald Butz. He always tells me a story on the phone that I can't use with mixed audiences. The last one was a real gem, so if you want to hear it, see me after the meeting. And I said to Earl one day, now that you're not traveling, where do you get these stories? And he said, well, there's a lot of dirty old men in the nursing home. And this summer, I reminded him that Bob Dole has taken his place. Now, think Earl Butz and think Bob Dole. The minute I said Bob Dole to Earl Butz, what do you think Butz said? Viagra. Just like that. And then I had to tell Earl this story about the time Dole turned 80 and we had a birthday party for him. And Elizabeth was with him, you know, the current Senator Dole from North Carolina. Southern lady, always has a big smile on her face. And a bunch of us were standing around there, and some of Bob's old cronies said to him, now, come on, Senator, you're 80 years old. Do those little blue pills really work? He pointed to the back of the room. There stood Senator Dole. And he said, look at the smile on her face. And she heard him. And I learned that Southern ladies can frown also. She knew exactly what he was pulling. And she gave him a real dirty look. And he turned his back and he said, well, boys, it won't work tonight. So that's what you got to look forward to at 80 years of age. You know, coming down here to talk to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, to talk to you all, who I affectionately call cowboys. I like that word. and it's not an insult, as some people think. I thought back in history. There was a time when the Farm Bill would not be on a cowboy college program. There was a time when the cattle industry spent almost no time on a Farm Bill. In those days, there were basically one public issue that you all worried about, and that was importing that damn stringy stuff from Australia and Argentina. Look how far we've come. Now the cattle industry is a major player in this Farm Bill. And you could see the hand of NCBA this morning when the secretary announced the administration's proposals for the Farm Bill. And so then I made a list of the impacts that the Farm Bill and ag policy are having on the cattle industry. And of course, we'll start with the feed grain program. And then we'll immediately go to ethanol. We will go to conservation programs like EQIP and CRP and CSP. Then we'll go to something called COOL, packer ownership, trade, BSE, immigration, animal ID. And the other day I was reviewing some of this literature on animal ID, and the television was on, and I heard the speaker, the person that was being interviewed, talk about immigration. And I thought, you know, the solution to immigration is really through animal ID. We just give every immigrant a cow and we'll solve both problems, you see. And we are certainly better at tracking cows than we are immigrants. So there's a, what's that big word? Symbiotic relationship or something like that. There's no end to these issues. And they're not going away. So we're going to talk about some of those this afternoon. And by the way, I assume you all know I'm Barry Flinchbaugh from Kansas State University. I've got my purple shirt on and ready to go. The person in agriculture that I run into today, that is interesting to talk to, is that old boy that gets half of his income from the livestock industry and half of his income from growing corn. He's perplexed. He's confused. He smiles out of one side of his mouth and cusses out of the other. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. How many in here think they will live to see $2 corn again? It's a minority. I agree with the minority. And we'll talk about that. I was a founding member of a group called 25 by 25. 25% of this nation's energy will come from renewables by 2025. I view the current situation as temporary. We'll talk about that. Now, let's right out of the chute make a statement. Since the November election, we have been reading and hearing about all this change Madam Speaker, the irony of this is that all of this so-called change in the nation's capital, I'm convinced, means less change for the Farm Bill. The chairman of the Senate Ag Committee is Senator Harkin from Iowa. Many forget that he was the chair when the O2 bill was written. And he likes what he did. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee is Congressman Peterson from Minnesota. He was in the minority in O2, but he's a seasoned legislator, and he likes what they did in O2. And our system puts considerable power in the hands of the chairs. So we will be talking about tweaking the Farm Bill. We will not be talking about overhauling it. Now, those are two general terms which can bring forth different meanings. So we'll need to put a little meat on the bones. I believe in that old adage that, as an economist, if you can't explain what you're trying to talk about in the Queen's English without any equations and charts, you really don't understand it. But an economist is not supposed to make a presentation without charts. I am basically computer illiterate. Can't type. Use two fingers. They set this all up for me. I'm on my own, but to make sure, you have a booklet in front of you that has all these charts in it if this damn thing doesn't work. I used to use overheads, but none of these fancy hotels have an overhead machine anymore. So I've got to use this thing. In front of you is a chart that kind of sets the stage. It's the history of net cash farm income. And historically, the last 10 years, we've been above average. And in 2005, we had a record year. And then a huge drop predicted for 06. Numbers are not completely in yet, at least reliable numbers. This chart, I would argue, takes a net cash farm income down too low. But that is basically a reminder that 06 was a tough year from the standpoint of the cost of energy, the cost of fertilizer, etc. Many of the predictions for 07 is that we will get back up close to our record. Time will tell. Now let's see if this thing works. Well, this is a history of government program payments. And you will note that the record year was in 2000 with over $32 billion. And you can follow along in your booklet with these charts. That's a record in what's called nominal dollars, current dollars, not real dollars which are adjusted for inflation. The record is still in 1986 when you look at real dollars, when we spent close to $26 billion. Now, point number one that I want you to remember. Average expenditures for farm programs in recent years have hovered around $20 billion. That will continue. And what we need to understand right out of the chute, and we're going to get a projection from the Congressional Budget Office on what's called the baseline. And it will show less expenditures on the new farm bill than the '02 farm bill. That will happen. We will authorize less money on the new farm bill than we did on the '02 farm bill. Now, when that happens, farm organizations are going to come unglued. The Secretary this morning made a strong point in that their proposal spends $5 billion more than what we would have spent if the '02 farm bill was simply extended. That is a political point that he made succinctly. The year of debate on farm bills is amazing. And this farm bill has already been cussed and discussed and analyzed more than any in history. And front and center, if you listen to the pundits, is that it's the budget, the budget, the budget. Especially when we have so-called record federal budget deficits. Now, I would suggest when the Congress comes out with its new baseline that you all smile and don't take the bait. That's the history of budget deficits. And while you're pondering that, I always refer to this time, year before a new farm bill, as the time to scare the hell out of farmers and ranchers once again. Your congressman comes home. He tells you how tight the budget is. He points to deficits. And he tells you how difficult it's going to be to get this farm bill funded. He then gets it done. They find the money. He comes home the hero and gets reelected. Even my good friends Pat Roberts and Jerry Moran are guilty of that a little. It's part of the game. Now, there are two words that we need to understand when we're talking about the budget and we're talking about the money for a farm bill. Number one is authorization. Number two is appropriation. Authorization is what is authorized when the bill is passed. The 1986 farm bill, we authorized $42 billion for the life of that farm bill. We spent exactly double, $84 billion. The last year of the 96 farm bill, Freedom to Farm, we were to spend $4 billion. That's what was authorized when we passed it. We spent $16 billion. Farm program payments are entitlements. And it doesn't matter what's authorized. It's what's spent that counts. Now, this is going to provide a very unique year, budgetary-wise. When the Congressional Budget Office comes up with the baseline, they take the '02 bill, they score it on what it will cost its last year, what it cost in '06. That'll be the baseline. then they will estimate what's available based on the baseline for the life of the bill. Now, they will make the same assumptions. They'll use the same price levels that they've used in the baseline to make the predictions for the life of the bill. So we can leave the loan rate, the target price, and the direct payment at current levels, and it'll cost perhaps 50% of what it costs in 03, for example. In fact, we could increase the loan rate, the target price, and the direct payment, perhaps a small amount, and given price levels, actually spend less than what's in the baseline. And that will free up monies for conservation, energy, etc. That's where the Secretary is getting that $5 billion. So when the budget estimate comes out, shock them and thank them and let them be ignorant that they don't understand what it really means. I've been quoted as saying that the federal budget is irrelevant to farm bills. Very few other damn fools will say that. But it is true. Now, the biggest myth we're perpetuating at the moment is that we have record federal deficits. You all remember exactly a year ago today what happened? God retired. Remember? Who was God? Greenspan. He's been replaced by a man by the name of Bernanke. Very quiet, soft-spoken gentleman that has basically continued Mr. Greenspan's policies. I find him very fascinating. You ought to look at his pedigree. He either graduated from or taught at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Stanford. And he still speaks English. And we're very chagrined at K-State that we aren't on that list. And, of course, those arrogant Jayhawks down the river pretend that they are on that list, and they really aren't. But when Greenspan retired, the federal budget deficit was 2.7% of the gross domestic product of the American economy. Very manageable. Now, I don't want anybody leaving here and saying, well, that egghead economist from Kansas said the budget deficit isn't important. It is important. It's passing the buck to the next generation. But we don't have record federal deficits. They are manageable, and they haven't anything to do with this farm bill debate. Now, it may surprise you that when Greenspan became chair of the Fed, 20 years ago, the federal budget deficit was 3.2% of the gross domestic product of the American economy. We do not have record federal deficits. And between 05 and 06, we cut the deficit 21%. A fairly good track record. So let's not waste any time on worrying about is there enough money in the budget for the farm bill. But you say, well, the Congress has changed hands. It's a new ball game. Well, if you look at history in the last quarter century, the Democrat slogan has been tax, 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 spend, 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 spend. And the Republican slogan has been borrow, 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 spend, 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 spend. And that's the only difference. So, there will be money for this farm bill. Absolutely no question about it. Now, having said all that, remember that it will authorize less expenditures than the O2 farm bill. But what's important is what is finally spent through appropriations. I'm getting pretty good at this. We're not done yet, though. This map, I would argue, is crucial to the farm bill debate. If you're interested in this study in depth, go on the web, agmanager.info. That's the K-State Ag Economics website. This is an estimate to what would happen to land values if we pulled the plug on farm permits. It's that ancient capitalization principle which we have not been able to figure out how to repeal. Now, this chart assumes that 100% of farm program payments get capitalized into land values. Now, is it 100%? I've seen estimates from 10% to 90%. But we all know the principle holds. Farm program payments get capitalized into land values and rental values. This shows, for example, that if we pulled the plug on farm programs in Kansas, land values would decline 36%. Now look at our friends south of the border, Oklahoma, 45.3%. Go to the northern border, North Dakota, 44.9%. Now, I presented this chart at the meeting of the Agriculture Bankers Conference put on by the American Bankers Association. And very interestingly, they all wanted a copy of this chart. And they are a strong supporter of farm programs. And that explains it. Even if only 50% would get capitalized, in North Dakota, for example, that would still mean a 25% decline if we pulled the plug on farm programs. This is the economic capitalization of farm programs. Many of you have told me over the years, the problem with you economists is that you never have any answers. You always in the end say, well, it's political. And there's a reason why I say that, because it is. There are no answers that can be provided through economic analysis on public issues. In the end, it is a political economy. Now there's another map. Don't have it here. You all can visualize it. It's that blue and red map that appears on election night. And interestingly enough, if you start at the tip of Texas and go to North Dakota, and you add Louisiana and Arkansas, you find the 8 states that have the most to lose if we pulled the plug on farm programs. And if you go back to the 04 election, you find something very interesting. You take those 6 states from Texas to North Dakota, you add Wyoming because of the quail hunter, and then you add Utah, I've got a lot of good Mormon friends. They're not Democrats. Those are the 8 states that gave George W. Bush his largest margin in 04. So the political map and the economic map coincide. Then you say, well, 04 is ancient history. He's a lame duck. His popularity's down to 32%. Have you forgotten the 06 election? Why did the Congress change hands in 06? Who did it? Not the blue states on either coast. It was the red states that voted blue. That great Republican state of Kansas now has a Democrat governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and a new Democrat congresswoman. It was the heartland that changed the Congress. And elections are just like price. They are determined on the margin. And this gave us political power in both parties. And so I would argue that the political map and the economic map closely coincide. So there will be a farm bill. It will be adequately funded. We won't steal from commodity programs to fund conservation and energy, as we're currently hearing. The budget is adequate, and the politics is right. Now, those who argue that this is the year when we're going to pull the rug out from under farmers just don't get it. They remind me of that fifth grader that came home one night with a report card, D's and F's. Father was angry, pounded the table, and said, "Why, son? What went wrong?" And the kid said, "Well, it's either hereditary or environmental." That's the problem with some of these pundits. It's one or the other. Now, these charts are not quite in the right order, so let's see if we can find... There we go. This is an interesting chart. This just applies to Kansas, although if I had numbers, they would coincide in other states. 2004... a record year for net farm income. The average farm family in the state of Kansas had a net income of $62,000. $25,000 of the $62,000 in an excellent year came from government program payments. 40%. This is extremely serious business when we talk about the well-being of farm country and a farm bill. These are real numbers. These come from 2,500 farm families in the state of Kansas that belong to the Kansas State University Farm Management Associations. These numbers are accurate and uniform. Interestingly enough, in 05, it shows that the top quartile had an average net income of $170,000, and the bottom quartile lost $18,000. And therein lies the real story of American agriculture. All right, now let's, if we can find the right charts, let's move international for a moment. Eighteen months ago, the scenario on the farm bill went this way. The Republicans are in control in Washington. They worry about market distortion. They want to put a safety net under farm income, but they want to distort the market the least. And we'll talk about that more later. But that really doesn't matter because the WTO is going to force us to clean up our act on farm permits. The famous cotton case, which those of you from the South, those of you from Tennessee, understand. In feed grain country, we kind of smirked about that. That was cotton's problem, when in fact it is everybody's problem. And so we had to clean up our act on these farm programs. We had to move in the direction of less market distortion. Because the WTO said so. Well, the WTO talks have been suspended. They're not dead. But they clearly are in the shape that, how do you say it, Barbaro, the famous racehorse, how do you pronounce that? Barboa? Something like Barbaro? All right, we're close. They're clearly in the shape that horse was in for months. They're in intensive care, but they're not dead. And there will be an attempt to resurrect them. It's going on right now for one simple reason, and that is that the negotiating authority of the President of the United States under what's called Fast Track expires July 1. But the suspension of the WTO talks have clearly taken pressure off to overhaul this farm bill. Now, this is an interesting chart. In agriculture, we can no longer brag about how much we contribute to the trade surplus. And actually, the trade deficit is running about $880 billion a year. That chart's in the book. It's the very last, so we won't go to it yet. And look what's happened. We have went from, or have gone from, I guess is correct, a trade surplus in the agriculture sector of $26.8 billion in 1996 to $3.5 billion in 2006. We import almost as much of agricultural products as we now export. And of course, part of the problem is that Korea and Japan are using bogus science to protect their beef industries. We all know that. That's part of the problem. But the number one product that has changed this, I have fun with my students on this, you know, I ask them, what is the number one product that changed this? And they go all over the map. And then I ask them where they're going tonight, and they say Aggieville. That's the local bar hangout in Manhattan, Kansas. And I tell them, well, you're part of the problem. What has changed this chart? Booze! Wine! Beer! Whiskey! Won't make any comment on that. Just, it's a fact. Now, this is this trade deficit. Now, many bemoan that. It's basically less than 5% of gross domestic product. We can handle it. It shows that the dollar is balanced to the point that we can buy cheap imports. It clearly benefits the consumer. And it's not a threat to the economy. Strong nations run trade deficits. So, sure, this is a concern. It's something we should pay attention to. But it's nothing to panic about. Now let's go back. I would submit if you want to be knowledgeable as you're debating this farm bill, that you should learn this chart. Because that's really what the debate is all about. That's what the debate is about on farm policy in this country. This is what the debate's about at the WTO. It is conventional wisdom that what the WTO was trying to do was to get us to spend less money on farm programs. And therefore we had to cut the budget. And the administration announced that we were willing to cut market-distorting farm programs 60% if the Europeans would give us access to their markets. And what was the headline the next morning? Bush wants to cut farm program 60%. WTO is forcing it. That's all hogwash. WTO uses what's called boxes. Green, amber, blue, and red. There are no red programs, and nobody understands the blue ones. It's where you put something when you don't know where to put it. And the debate's between green and amber. And this is the spectrum. On the right, and it's no accident, I deliberately put it on the right. No distortion, free market. It's been dead for 100 years, isn't coming back. But we still like to talk about it. Then on the left, and again, no accident, mandatory production controls, quotas and allotments. The old peanut program, the old tobacco program, and the only one left, the sugar program. Now that's the spectrum. We got them boxed in. Now if you go back to the right, move slightly left to the decoupled fixed payment. That's in the green box. No limit. We have a problem with the green box right now. In that if you go back to the 96 Farm Bill, in order to get that bill passed, we needed one more vote. And Chairman Roberts convinced Ranking Minority Kika de la Garza to support the bill. But the price we paid was, under that decoupled fixed payment, you could grow anything, still get your payment, except fruits and vegetables. That's the pound of flesh that Kika extracted to vote for the bill. WTO says that means it's not in the green box. So if you looked at the Secretary's proposal this morning, there's several billion dollars in there for research and development and market assistance for fruits and vegetables. We're going to bribe them. In order to get that, they'll have to give up that exemption. And they'll fight that tooth and nail, and they know privately it doesn't amount to a tinker's dam. And they'll get a billion or two. So we could take that 60% that the president said we'll cut. We'll take it out of the next two programs, the countercyclical and the marketing loan, put it all over in the direct fixed payment in BWTO legal. It's not how much you spend, it's how you spend it. And you will note again in the Secretary's proposals this morning, there was about a 7% increase in the direct payment. So now let's keep moving left. And as you move left, you get more and more market distortion. I don't think there's any question that the current countercyclical program is in the amber box, and certainly the marketing loan is in the amber box. And the old non-recourse loan, which is still on the books, but is not used very often. Now, that amber box has a $19.1 billion limit of what we can spend. The Secretary had a very unique proposal this morning. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens. Normally, administration farm bills are DAO when they hit the hill. It's called dead on arrival. This is not an actual bill. This is a series of proposals. And Secretary Johannes and Senator Harkin had a love-in the other day. We'll see how deep it is. They did. I mean, both smiling big time. I've argued that when we added the countercyclical payment to the 96 Farm Bill in 2002, which is basically what we did, we took a step backwards. My grandfather had a way of explaining that. He would say it was blank backwards. Now, come on, you cowboys know what I'm talking about. You'll force me to say it in a minute. And it is backwards. We set a target price. We have widespread drought. We don't have anything to sell. We're in trouble. Prices above target, no payment. Then we have a bumper crop, great weather. We got something to sell. We'll make some money. Prices below target. And we get a payment. Something not quite right about that. I call it KU math back home. And those of you from Colorado, it's clearly CU math, you see. Now, the Secretary proposed that we take out the words target price and put in the words target revenue. And there are proposals that have been written in depth. The Zuloff proposal out of Ohio State University will do the job, and it's simple. Sets a nationwide target revenue. Solves the problem of target price. Chairman Peterson has been making some noise about a permanent disaster program. This could be viewed as a permanent disaster program. And then, of course, the marketing loan. It is extremely market distorting. It guarantees a price on current production. Now, some people have looked at what happened in November, and they make a false conclusion. In the House, it was to be Chairman Goodlatte, Virginia. It's now Chairman Peterson, Minnesota. From cotton to feed grains. In the Senate, it was Chairman Chambliss from Georgia. It's now Chairman Harkin from Iowa. Again, cotton to feed grains. And some people are saying that cotton's in trouble. Anybody that says that has no idea where little babies come from when we write farm bills. Cotton is by far the most powerful commodity organization, at least on the crop side. I got out of that one, didn't I? But the power has shifted, and so there will be more of a compromise. Now, let's move into a couple other subjects on this farm bill, and then we'll have a dialogue. We'll tweak the commodity programs. We put them to bed. We may go from this countercyclical price program to the countercyclical revenue program. We will see. But clearly, three things will get a lot of discussion. Conservation, rural development, and energy. Rural development historically has been the poor stepchild of commodity programs. That is somewhat different this time because rural development has been tied to renewable fuels. And clearly the sexy kid on the block these days is renewable fuels. Conservation. We have made a change in our conservation policy. We have switched to, or rather from, conservation on retired lands to conservation on working lands. The O2 Farm Bill had in it the brainchild of Chairman Harkin. It was called the Conservation Security Program. He got it authorized. $2 billion. What do we spend? $200 million. Now that explains, again, authorization versus appropriation. And that's not an entitlement. He clearly intends to fully fund the Conservation Security Program to the tune of at least $1 billion, if not $1.5 billion. So now let's spend the rest of our time talking about energy. The O2 Farm Bill was the first farm bill that had an energy plank in it. The Secretary this morning proposed billions. Haven't added them all up yet because I haven't read it in depth. For something called cellulosic ethanol. Now, perhaps it's time for us to talk straight with each other on this issue. Renewable fuels has your attention. $4 corn always gets the attention of the cattle industry. This is the third time in my professional life where I've heard this scenario. $5 corn, $10 beans, $7 wheat. In the 70s, we had to feed the world. Commodity prices were going to rise and have a new plateau. In the late 80s and the early 90s, exports were going to do it. Not feed the world, not giveaway programs, China buying. You've all heard it. Now the third time, renewable fuels. Now, number one, let me tell you what 25 by 25 means. It's been strongly misinterpreted. It means that 25% of this nation's energy consumption will come from renewables in 2025. Biofuels, wind, solar, hydro, nuclear. It does not mean that 25% will come from ethanol made from corn. That is impossible. Ten years ago, I spoke to the Illinois Corn Growers Association. I made sure I was paid for that speech before I gave it. Because I looked them straight in the eye and I said, ethanol won't work. Can't compete. Why? Or more importantly, what would it take to make ethanol from corn kernels work? Number one, expensive oil. Number two, cheap corn. And it's always amused me that corn growers' associations supported cheap corn when it comes to ethanol. Number three, tax abatements. Number four, enforcement of the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. And number five, improvement in the conversion ratios. 05 and 06, at least the first half of 06, all five of those things came true. And today all five of them are true except one. And that's cheap corn. I need not tell you about expensive oil. The tax abatements are in place. We've got this former oil man turned cowboy for president. And he ruled against MTBE in California and is enforcing the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. But most important is the conversion ratio. 10 years ago, we put a BTU in, and if we were fortunate, we got a BTU out from corn ethanol. We put a BTU in, and we got a BTU out from soy biodiesel. Today, the corn ratio is 1.7, and the soy ratio is 3.25. That and that alone is the most important reason of why renewable fuels will work. So I admitted to the corn growers that I was wrong. I really wasn't. I said those five factors is what would have to happen, and they did. But they felt good, and I kind of, it was all right. So I said, well, the old man's wrong. Now they're mad at me again. Because 10 years from now, we will make more ethanol, significantly more ethanol, from cellulosic sources than we will from corn kernels. The technology is here in the laboratory. Two prototypes are being built to take it commercial. Wood chips. Go to Alabama. And the supply of wood chips is unlimited. There is such a thing. Switchgrass. We can grow that on CRP land effectively, harvest it after the birdies have hatched, so the Audubon people are pleased. Pheasants forever. You're not going to haul switchgrass very far. So the jobs are going to be right in that small town.